I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The New Yorker's Adam Gopnik joins me now. He has just published a new book, At the Stranger's Gate, Arrivals in New York. It's a lovely memoir about how he and his soon-to-be wife, Martha, leave Montreal for New York City in their 20s in the early 1980s. The book is a portrait of New York, the tiny apartments they live in, and how they go about making it in a city where if you can make it there, as the song says, you can make it anywhere. You get the loving portraits of the people along the way, luminaries, artists, and mentors that Gopnik encounters. One also gets a sense of the creativity and aspiration that pulsates in New York City. Adam Gopnik is the award-winning writer and author who has been writing for The New Yorker since 1986. He has received a George Polk Award for magazine reporting and three national magazine awards. He received the Medal of Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters from the French Republic. His previous books include Paris to the Moon, Through the Children's Gate, The Table Comes First, and Angels and Ages. This new book is published by Knopf. There will be at least three appearances at the Vancouver Writers' Fest. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for tickets. Please welcome to the Planta Online program in Kingston today, Adam Gopnik. Mr. Gopnik, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Delighted.
So you're in Kingston when I'm talking to you this week. You've just been everywhere, I guess, over the last few weeks, and you'll be in Vancouver later in the month, right?
I'll be in Vancouver later in the month. I'll be in Montreal, my hometown, in the middle of the month on October, I think it's 17th and 18th. I'm a bit of everywhere.
Now, when you're in Canada, do you still feel Canadian at all?
Yes, in a word. You know, my parents live on a farm in Campbellford, Ontario. Mm-hmm. So they're deeply Canadian people, and all of my wife's family live in Western Canada, mostly in Edmonton right now. So it is like coming home. Montreal in particular, of course, is my hometown, but not just by name, but in that kind of deep feeling you have for a place. I root for Montreal sports teams, and I long for Montreal bagels, and I think of the landscape of the place where I learned or got all the crucial lessons you get in life, first love, broken hearts, all of that, was in Montreal. So I feel intensely a Montrealer and generally a Canadian. So yes, I'm always glad to be home.
So in the early 80s, what brought you to New York City from Montreal?
The same thing, and I try and say it in the book, there was nothing lacking in Montreal particularly. Yeah. Montreal was a wonderful place to grow up. It was just the force, I guess, that throughout history drives young men and women out of their hometowns towards the metropolis, towards the cosmopolitan capital. It's sort of one of the great themes of certainly literature, but also of just of human life, that you become eager to find out what life is like in the big town or the biggest town there is. So that's sort of what drove us to New York. We had visited my then-girlfriend, Martha, who soon became my wife, and I had visited New York in the summer of 1978, and even though it was a very low point in the city's history, we had both been bedazzled by it, not least because of the abundance of jazz clubs that was still around and playing the kind of jazz I love, which is sort of swing and sort of classic cool jazz. So that was one thing. Of course, once we got to New York, we never got to another jazz club, but it was part of one of the things that drew us.
It's one of the things you write about in the book, that you do all the touristy things, I guess, in the first little bit, and then you never
do them. Then you never do them again. You have about a 6-week bender of exploration, and let's go take the Staten Island Ferry, and let's visit all the gates of Central Park and all of those things. And then after about 6 weeks are gone, your life is reduced to one block, one deli, and in our case, one tiny 9x11 room.
Yeah, it's a city that fascinates a lot of people, and it's not just from the books that we've read, but from the television or the films that we've seen. But it's such a part of it's that song. If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. So when you get there in the 80s, you and Martha are very young, and I think you're living on a scholarship. Is that right?
Yeah, from McGill, Moyne Traveling Fellowship. I had the princely sum of $3,500 to live for a year in New York.
So I'm wondering, as I'm reading the book, how you're able to afford it. Was it like it is now? I don't think 20-year-olds today could go to New York and do what you guys did, or could they?
We couldn't afford it. We afforded it by not, that's why we lived in a tiny space. We lived in a little 9x11 room. I no longer remember what the monthly rent was, but it was not very much.
Yeah.
And it was, and for good reason, it was not very much because you didn't have very much living area. I had a job eventually at the Frick Art Reference Library, which I write about in the book. And Martha was at first at Parsons and then at Columbia, and she had a job at as a film editor. She was apprenticing as a film editor, so she did film syncing. So in that way of young people, we got a little bit here and a little bit there, and we made our way. You know, to be honest, look, we had a kind of a net back home in Canada, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we weren't going to end up on the street. We just would have ended up back on the bus, headed home from Montreal. But that was not what we wanted to do. That would have been an enormous defeat.
Yeah. It's the 80s in New York compared to the 70s, because you mentioned, you know, the first time you visited, it was very gritty. I mean, you know, it's Taxi Driver, it's the Deuce. What's it like in the 80s? I mean, is it Trump and Wall Street yet, or?
Yes, yeah, that stuff was happening. That was exactly the moment. We arrived when it was still very much Taxi Driver New York, when Martha was working as a film editor on 9th Avenue and 45th Street, and in her first day at work, they found a dead body in the dumpster. So from that point on, I thought I should really walk her home, you know, take her home in the subway. So yes, it was still very much that kind of steam from Manholes, Harvey Keitel, Pimps and Whores, and Psychotic Taxi Drivers New York. But within that New York, you were already beginning to see the signs of the kind of urban renewal that later got slimed as gentrification or, you know, yuppiedom and so on. You're beginning to see an influx of young people into the city. That urge to come back to New York was still, had become again extremely strong. And you watched that grow. And then by the middle of the decade, by 1983 or 1984, the signs of what we had come to associate with the decade, the influx of money, the sudden rush, which had a kind of feverish quality to it, of not just prosperity, but kind of hyper-prosperity, affluence, returned in a very unexpected way. No one expected New York to take that kind of turn. New York seemed dead and decrepit in 1979. So it was simultaneously exciting and frightening, because you recognized that there was some fundamental change happening in the world, and New York was kind of the navel of that transformation.
So you get to the New Yorker in 1980. Was it 86 or 87?
86.
Yeah. So was that the goal when you get to the city in the early 80s?
Well, the goal I had, as I write in the book, I had more goals than is probably prudent to have. My chief goal, to be honest with you, was to be a songwriter, to write musical shows, to be Stephen Sondheim only wittier, if that makes any sense. That was my chief goal. And as I explained in the book, we had once met someone who had once been to dinner with someone who knew Art Garfunkel's psychotherapist. So we made a cassette of songs of my work to give to Art. We never heard back from it. But that ambition didn't work out particularly well, and it's only now, 30 plus years later, that I'm actually have been working professionally or as a songwriter. I wrote the score, or the lyrics for a score of a musical show that opened in New Haven a couple of months ago. But my other ambition, yes, was to be a writer, an essayist, and I certainly was focused on the New Yorker in as much as my favorite writers as a kid and as an adolescent, S.J. Perlman and James Thurber, E.B. White, and A.J. Liebling, were all New Yorker writers. So my ambition wasn't to be to write for the New Yorker because it was a prestigious literary magazine. It was because it was the place that White and Thurber and Liebling and Mitchell had all written for.
Yeah. You leave for Paris after how long?
We left for Paris in 1995, I guess, the beginning of 95, just after our son Luke was born.
Yeah, and so what brings you back to New York, and what's kept you there? Because, I mean, it's an expensive city. You know, there are problems like any...
Ridiculously expensive. And a lot of its culture is being homogenized, and schools are a problem, and all of that. Two things, I guess, Joe. One is the simple and kind of crazy thing. It's home. At the end of 37 years, though we spent six of those in Paris, at the end of those 37 years, home is home, you know, and it's hard to leave the circles of intimates and the... all those smaller ties. You know, you're no longer attached to the city as an idea. You're attached to the city as this endless number of tiny communities to which you belong, from your closest friends to the guys you see at the gym. So that's one reason. You're just the magnetism of the familiar. But the other reason is that I really love cities. I can't imagine living outside a city. Mm. We were lucky enough to live in Paris, which is a great city, but in many ways, sadly, a somewhat stultified city, a city that emphasizes continuity at the cost of a certain kind of claustrophobia. And New York, with all of its difficulties, is still, or at least seems to be still, a city of the possibility of renewal and the possibility of possibility. You know, I did a whole book through the Children's Gate that was essentially about how New Yorkers survived 9/11 and the years after. And as you may recall, after 9/11, the thing everyone was saying, the word was, it was, you know, catastrophic, it should stay in the city. And New York regenerated itself from the ground up just by the propulsion of people's hopes, and by people insisting that they were going to live their hopes and not their fears. Everyone except Donald Trump, who lives only his fears.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why I love New York. I love cities, and New York is, you know, someone said once, a skunk isn't a worse smell than any other smell, it just is more smell than any other smell.
Yeah.
And New York isn't a better city than any other city, but it is more city than any other city I know.
So you've worked as a writer, as an essayist at the New Yorker since 86, mm-hmm. and then you mentioned a moment ago that you've been able to work in sort of the musical area. Mm-hmm. This process of reinvention, it seems to me like someone that you write about in the book, a mentor of yours, Richard Avedon,
yep.
who seemed to reinvent himself every year or
every
as
decade,
yeah, as fashions changed. It's so beautiful when you write about people like him and people that you've encountered, people who become friends, who become mentors, and what he meant to you.
Well, I'm glad you liked that part of the book. It was very important. That was, to be honest, a crucial experience of my experience. And I get indignant when people say, as they occasionally do, oh, you know, you shouldn't, you know, drop a name or something. But, you know, name dropping is when you talk about people who you don't know and pretend to.
Yeah.
And one of, I think, an obligation that we have when we write about our experience is to write about the people who changed our experience and to write about the people, you know, we wouldn't want to read Boswell without reading about Dr. Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And I had in Dick Avedon, particularly, a remarkable mentor. I hate that word mentor because it sounds like it's a locus of favors exchanged somehow. Just a teacher, a charismatic teacher, someone who shows you the world, a kind of second father. I have a fantastic father in Campbellford, Ontario.
Yeah.
But we all need second fathers, someone who can show us a specialized world. And exactly as you say, one of the things that made Dick Avedon such a magical figure was that he did reinvent himself, not you know, self-consciously the way Madonna used to. You know, you knew the reinvention was on its way, but he vibrated in tune to his time. And as the times changed, he changed with it. So it was very much a 50s Avedon as an artist and as a man, a 60s and a 70s. And there's no question that gave me, we learn from the people we admire. And I admired his ability to do that. And it's certainly one of the things he pressed into my character. Are you pushing farther? Are you doing something new? Are you doing something audacious? Are you doing something risky? And though my writing, I don't think, is famous for its surface audacity, you know, I don't write about murder or raw sex or violence, I hope that there's a sort of subterranean audacity about the simple act of trying to be honest about your own experience.
I mean, did you see people in your life who regard you in the same way that you regarded Avedon?
You know, you never can see that, right? Because by the time you're on the other end of it, you're so conscious of your own frailties and incapacities that you can't believe anybody would in any sense look to you. But I'm aware of it. You know, I've had a wonderful run of apprentices, assistants, almost all of them young women, who've come to work with me, and I'm sort of stunned when when I see them again after they leave after a year or so, I see them again, you know, we have dinner 2 years later, and they say, oh, I learned so much from the way that you put music on when you were writing, or from the way you spoke to your editor, or all, you know, the things that we have that change people's lives are not the things we're conscious of. It's the little unexpected mannerisms. In the book, right, I talk about how the first night that I had dinner with Dick Avedon, he used this expression over and over again. When he was admiring something, he said, "It's so beautiful and strange. It's so beautiful and strange. Mm. And the coupling of those two words, strange and beautiful, was astounding to me. It was a whole new way of thinking about what made things beautiful, that they had to be strange at the same time. A quicker person than me would have figured it out before, but I needed that. I'm sure that on Dick's side, if he could hear me say that now from heaven or hell or wherever he might be, he would be shocked. It was just a turn of phrase. It was just an expression. You know, I interpreted it as having more significance than he intended to give it. And I think that's the way we tend to change other people.
You write in the book, too, about being married to Martha, and it's about 37 years now, is it?
Yeah, since 1980, yeah. Yeah,
and you were quite young when you got married. Is there a secret to a long marriage? I mean, is getting married at a young age, because a lot of people that get married at a young age, you know, don't stay married.
I would never recommend it to anybody. In fact, I would recommend against it. My own kids now,
yeah.
My son, my older son, Luke, is approaching the age at which we got married, and I'd be terrified if he told me he was planning to get married to his high school girlfriend and then go off to, I don't know, Melbourne, Australia, right?
Yeah.
I think that there's no pattern for a good marriage. You know, in a book I wrote called Angels and Ages, which was a book about Darwin and Lincoln and liberal style.
Beautiful book.
Thank you. It's sort of a kind of slightly invisible book of mine, but one I like. And in it, buried within it, I don't think anyone ever noticed it, I have a little thing about how Darwin had a fabulous marriage, he and his wife Emma, and I had a little thing about the secret to a good marriage. And of course, I was reflecting, knock wood, because, you know, every marriage is always in some jeopardy, that every relationship is.
Yeah.
That the key to a good marriage was the combination, a sort of formula of lust and laughter and loyalty. You had to have all three L's going at the same time. I should have written a self-help book instead of Angels and Ages. It would have probably sold a lot more. But what I posited was is that the natural sort of gravitational weight of or the direction of marriages is you end up just with loyalty. And we all know so many marriages that are just exercises in pure loyalty. And the mistake, I said, and I think this is true, is people try to get back to lust, which is sort of the germ of all romance, by going, you know, you go away for Caribbean weekend or something, and you can only get back to it, you can only get from loyalty back to lust by way of laughter. You have to reaffirm the things that you share, that entertain you, make you happy before you can renew your romance. So that's my theory of a happy marriage: lust, laughter, and loyalty, with laughter always being the pivot between the other two.
Well, what do your kids think of the writing you do, and not just about them, but in this book about sex with their mom?
They were terror. They were embarrassed and terrified and amused. And I think, to be fair to both of us, they're good readers, both of them. My son Luke is the only person, he's certainly more than I have done, he's been right through all of Nausgard, you know, my struggle and all.
Oh,
that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He's a good big reader, and my daughter Olivia is more like me. She's a quick, avid reader. So they have enough experience of writing and literature to sort of know that that's what writing is about. You know, writing is about making private life public. It's about other things, but that's one of the central things it's about. And your obligation is to be honest about your private life. So that doesn't make it the single most embarrassing subject on the planet is your parents' sex life. You know, in fact, you could write almost any book could be called My Parents' Marriage, right? Because that's a core subject for all of us. So it's built in to be embarrassing, but I couldn't not, and I thought about not writing about it, to be perfectly honest, Joe, because I recognized the embarrassment factor in it, not just for my kids, but for readers, too. You know, readers can be uncomfortable about that. But, as you know, I said a moment ago that I don't think my work has a lot of overt audacity, maybe, but I think it has some covert audacity. And deciding just to write truthfully about, I mean, the section I wrote about sex and long marriage is hardly, Henry Miller.
Yeah.
But it to try and be honest about it, to try and address it honestly. I thought that was something that I owed my readers, but also I owed my own experience.
Did you wonder if you couldn't write, what would change about how you understood your life?
This will sound hyperbolic, but it's true. I can't imagine not writing. You know, if I couldn't write, I couldn't breathe. I'm one of those writers for whom the act of writing is actively pleasurable. I like to write. I know most writers say, oh, I hate to write. I hate to to, you know, it's a struggle and it's all of that. And, of course, it's a struggle for me. I don't write easily, and I have to work very, very hard at it 7 days a week. But experience doesn't make sense to me until it's organized in words. And one of the sad things about that is once it's organized in words, you sort of lose the experience. I spent those 5 years in Paris, 6 years, I guess it was, in all writing the book that eventually became Paris the Moon. And now I have total amnesia about what happened then because it all got transferred onto the page in lots of ways. I have total amnesia, but it doesn't have the intensity for me that, say, the period I was writing about in At the Stranger's Gate still did. And now that that stuff is out, it's a little, it's lost some of its mojo for me as well.
So then if you write about painful things that have happened in your life, does that make the pain go away then?
That's a good question. I don't think it makes the pain go away. The single most painful thing that ever happened in my life that I wrote about was that my other real teacher, the other greatest teacher I'd known in my life, Kirk Varnedoe, who's the curator of modern art at the Museum of Modern Art and a teacher of mine and my closest friend, died far too young, much younger than I am today, of colon cancer. He was 56. And he had been suffering for a long time. And as you know, the process of being cured of cancer is in itself a kind of disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a story about his last year of his life called "Last of the Metrozoids," spliced together, so to speak. He spent the last year of his life giving a brilliant series of lectures about modern art at the National Gallery in Washington and coaching a football team made up of 8-year-olds that my son Luke asked him to coach, and it was about the relationship between coaching the 8-year-olds and teaching modern art and what it is that makes a great teacher a great teacher. That story was essential to me, and I had to write it and organize it, and it made me feel, it didn't reduce my grief or my sense of loss that Kirk Varnedoe was no longer alive, but it did allow me to organize all of those harsh and perplexing and painful emotions in ways that made them marginally more tolerable.
See, I kind of wonder if people don't write what they've lost of their life or their understanding of life. Probably you have, because you've written for a long time.
I do, yeah. You know, I find, as I say, I obviously the gift for writing is, indifferently distributed and not everyone can do it, but my sympathies are with all the diary keepers of the 19th century. You know, when you discover somebody's unpublished diary, and it's very often, interesting, fascinating. We all live this weird way, Joe, it seems to me, which is that we all live these intense inner lives of desires and ambitions and illusions and absurdities, but we don't really credit that everybody else has exactly the same music running through their mind,
yeah.
And it's only through literature, fiction, nonfiction, diaries, memoirs, it doesn't matter. It's only through literature that we are actually reassured, we actually have it confirmed, that the mad music that runs through the human mind is always the same, with a few bizarre exceptions like Donald Trump, who have truly mad music, madder music, right?
Yeah.
But most of us, that music of ambition and aspiration and lust and disappointment, it's the one we all share, and we learn it, we sing it through writing.
This gift that you have, I mean, we've talked about writing, but I mean of storytelling, because you do storytelling in your writing, but I mean you also do that on stage. Where does this come from? Does this come from an early age, say?
Does it come from an early age?
Yeah.
Well, the hammy part of it, I think, comes from an early age. I was, believe it or not, or maybe it's all too believable, I was a kid actor, a child actor, and I did commercials and plays. Andre Gregory, my Dinner with Andre guy.
Oh yeah.
Had an avant-garde theater in Philadelphia, and I was sort of the Shirley Temple of the Philadelphia avant-garde, if you can imagine anything more obnoxious. But I was, and so I always liked being on stage. So that's part of it, the hammy part. Storytelling, as I try and explain in the book, and people may not see, and it's always frustrating to an author when readers or critics, anyway, don't always see their designs, but this book, though, it isn't melodramatic, and, we don't get, run over by a car or kidnapped by terrorists or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, it does have a is a story of transformation. I start out in the book as I was, as a graduate student who writes everything with buts, who's contentious and argumentative, and I tried to learn through that decade the art of storytelling, which I describe as writing with ands instead of buts, trying to make the shapes of your sentences inclusive and plural and not restrictive and merely contentious. So learning to write that way, learning to tell stories in that manner, learning to write with ands, learning to observe and listen rather than argue and contend, that was the transformation that I had to undergo. That was the learning I needed to do. That was the education I needed to get and that I hope this book traces.
What's it like for you as you encounter readers of yours who ask you about certain people that you've written about in the past, and especially about your family and the sort but people that you've encountered or that your family members encounter, and that they're interested in them?
I wish I could say I'm such a disciplined person that I say, please don't confuse the people you read about with the actual people, but I'm delighted. The truth is I love those encounters, and I love them because they work both ways. You know, I was in Toronto last night doing my little vaudeville show, and, you know, people come up afterwards, and they'll ask, you know, about the kids because they've read about them. And now the kids are not kids anymore. They're grown-ups or teenagers and grown-ups. And that feeling of connection that people have to your work is, I find, incalculably touching and moving. Actually, somebody came up to me, somebody who had just read the new book, and said, I was so glad you wrote about your relationship with a mentor, because I had a great mentor, a woman who was a dramaturgist, somebody I'd never met before, who was in the theater director, and said, who showed me what the theater was about. He said, if you're lucky, everybody has a relationship like that. So it was so nice to see a relationship of that kind written about, because they aren't enough. That for me is truly, unsentimentally, that's the reward of writing, is that sense of not of audience in the sense that, you know, they're cheering thousands, because God knows there aren't, but in the sense that you have connected your own experience with someone else's experience. And that, for me, is the alchemy of writing. Somehow the I that you offer becomes the you that gets read. And I will confess that I find it limitlessly touching and rewarding. And maybe in a certain way, Joe, that's, you know, I experience that stuff in certain ways more the way a performer experiences it than the way many writers experience it. There are many wonderful writers who want to stay home in surly isolation and would rather never meet a single reader, but I am not that writer.
You mentioned you put music on while you write, is that right?
Yeah, I put on loud rock music from my, you know, we all are convinced that the music of our high school years was the greatest popular music ever written, but in my case it's true, because the music of my high school years was the really good Rolling Stones and the end of the Beatles and Joni Mitchell and James Taylor, and so I play that music. Mostly, I must confess, the Rolling Stones Live in 1969. That's what gets me going every day.
You know what I listen to, and because I know you love jazz, and the Cafe Carlyle was a place that you
absolutely
went to. I love Bobby Short. Listening to CDs of him live or Sylvia Sims.
I love, that's my late night listening. And when I
really?
Get in bed
yeah.
at night to do some reading, I listen to the great cabaret singers, Bobby Short, Julie Wilson. I don't know if you're Julie Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
Julie Wilson, Mabel Mercer.
Oh, Mabel Mercer's, I think, everybody's favorite, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, and, you know, they're such fantastic artists, because neither Mabel Mercer nor Julie Wilson had a legit voice. You know, they weren't belters. They weren't, Barbara Streisand or, God help us, Celine Dion. But they convey emotion with such efficiency. That's what I lie in bed at night and listen to them sing. So they claim their own space, whereas at 9 in the morning I need something energetic, sort of like a shot of heroin, but I don't know what heroin is like, but certainly a shot of double caffeine in the rock music of my teenage years is certainly that.
How many books do you own?
Do I own?
Yeah.
I've never counted, but it's a lot. The walls, people are struck by it. When I hire an assistant, they're always struck by the number of books on the wall, but it never strikes me, because there's a kind of constant. We live in a New York apartment, and though it's bigger than the first New York apartment, that 9 by 11 room, it still is a New York apartment. So there's a kind of constant inflow and outflow of books into our place. You know, new books are coming in and old books are being taken off to the Strand. I hate giving up books. I hate up books. And finally, my wife waits for some time, like now when I'm on the road, and she makes the cull herself of books she knows will never be read again, because I can't do it. You know, books are astounding things, right? Every book that sits up on your shelf actually contains a world, and it's a world that you entered at one time or another, and disposing of it to the Strand, you know, the big used bookstore in New York, feels painful. Although I must add, whenever I go searching at the used bookstore, it's not infrequent for me to find signed copies of my own books that I gave with great fervor to a friend who clearly felt no compunction about getting rid of it herself. I name no names.
Yeah.
But so as I say, there's kind of tidal waves of books in and out of the house.
This is, as I told you before we started, such a beautiful book. I mean, this is a city that's fascinated me growing up. I went to it once, about 2-3 years ago, and the minute I walked out of Penn Station, I felt like I knew this place. Huh. And reading this book, I mean, even though, you know, you write about vermin and things like that, I mean, one aches to go back.
That's a lovely thing to hear. I'm conscious, you know, that I wrote about Paris, and Paris in a certain way was an easy thing to write about. Not that Paris is not a very complicated place, but just we all share one kind of common glamorous expectation of Paris. And even if you're writing against the glamour, so to speak, people are taken with it. New York is a thornier topic, I think, for people. People think in North America, certainly, even here in Canada, feel New Yorkers are, I don't know what, supercilious or something. But anyway, those are nice words for an author to hear.
They think that New York now is Trump, right?
Yes, but that's, you know, that drives me crazy, right? Because Trump is the least New York New Yorker around. He's never been perceived by New Yorkers as being even remotely New York. He's the only person I've ever heard of who calls Sixth Avenue in New York Avenue of the Americas, which is what some only real estate developers do.
Yeah.
He lives secluded in that ugly big tower of his own devising for which he tore down Bonwit Teller. There is truly no one less New York. And in all seriousness, it's one of the things I think that propels his politics is that he was never accepted by moneyed people in New York. Now, say what we will about moneyed people in New York, but they do have traditions of altruism and philanthropy. If you're going to be socially acceptable as a rich man in New York, you have to give money to the Metropolitan Museum or the Museum of Modern Art or the Metropolitan Opera or the New York City Ballet or some, even David Koch, you know, David Koch, the far right winger.
Yeah.
Built a theater for the New York City Ballet. So, and Trump never had done anything of that kind in his life. He has no philanthropic instinct at all, and that kept him out of from being accepted by moneyed elites in New York. He was accepted only by kind of mafia types. And I think it's one of the exclusions that fuels that enormous sense of grievance in him, which in the most bizarre alchemy in the history of the United States fuels similar sense of grievance in people whose experience could not be more unlike his. You know, so you have this bizarre thing of this billionaire guy from Queens being the tribune of, you know, poor whites in Alabama. It's crazy.
Did you have a sense of how this story ends?
Of the Trump story?
Yeah.
I wish I did. It keeps me up nights. It keeps me up nights as it does everyone. You know, there are two things going on. I spent all of 2015 and 2016 saying and writing in the New Yorker, especially online, that take this seriously. This is a very bad and damaged guy, and bad things will come of this, and he can win. And I was confident that he could win. Since he's been elected, I think two things have happened simultaneously. One bad, one very bad, and one better. The very bad thing is that he's every bit the man we thought he was. He's a man of absolutely no decent impulses. He's a man whose only impulses are towards violent domination and who cannot bear the thought that there are countervailing forces in the society that can intrude on his ego. He simply has no respect for the rule, not just no respect for the rule of law as a concept, it's in deep in his nature that anybody who tries to curb his ego is evil and has to be crushed. So he's even worse in that way. But he's also far more incompetent than we had feared. Mm. He's so oafish and easily distracted that so far, knock wood, he hasn't been able to do as much damage as he would like to do. And the race between those two things, between his, between his ego and his oafishness, is going to dominate our lives, I fear, for a little while. Except the only thing I would add to that, Jones, what I tell my kids when we have conversations about this, you know, short of the tyrannical imposition of authoritarian rule, we mustn't let him make our lives. We build our lives and our meanings out of the things that we compose from the ground up, not out of what's given to us from above. As I said to my daughter the night after he was elected, when she was understandably, and like so many 17-year-old girls, terribly traumatized, I said to her, Barack Obama didn't cut your sandwiches. Barack Obama didn't make your sandwiches. And Donald Trump can't keep your sandwiches from you. And I think that's a good rule of life.
And there's so much, you know, great films and television, great books like this that you know, we can bury ourselves in for a little bit at least.
Yes, and not lose ourselves in. Yeah. Not lose ourselves in, but find ourselves in.
Right.
You know, in books and art of all kinds, we find ourselves and we say, you know what, this creates our community. And it's through those communities that we, at least spiritually, oppose autocracies of all kinds.
Now, I know that's you and Martha on the spine of the book. Is that you and Martha on the cover?
It is indeed. It was our actual wedding day. I write about our official, no, I beg your pardon, our official wedding day. Our actual wedding day was in December of 1980. Our ceremonial wedding day was in Montreal in the summer of 81. You know, we had a wedding in Martha's family's garden. And my little brother was taking pictures of us, and Martha, to my shock, suddenly leaned over and kissed me. I described that moment in the book because, I thought we were all in the living room. I thought, you know, I don't deserve her. And her mother thought, he really doesn't deserve her. Her mother never, bless her, did not like me for the first 20 years of our relationship. And my little brother Blake took the picture. He was studying to be a photographer. And the joke of it is, it's a wonderful picture.
Yeah.
The jacket designer, a brilliant guy named Chip Kidd, saw it and said, okay, that's the cover. And he said, oh, you mean it's like an element in a collage that will be the cover? He said, no, that's the cover. And I said, okay, if you think. What's nice about this, because you can't see our faces, is exactly, I think, that we become a kind of universal couple, any young couple dressed up for their wedding and starting out in life. But I was going to add that my little brother was imitating Avedon at that point, but we had never met him. So various people in the British edition were very nervous that they were going to have to pay Avedon prices for the cover image. And I reassured, I said, no, you just have to pay Blake Gopnik prices. I think he'll give you the photo for the price of a good dinner.
It's a great circle, isn't it? I mean, you know, these things that influence you at a young age or that influence your brother at a young age, you know, they all come back in some form. And you know, that photo from, you know, 37 years ago is now the cover of a book like this. And you write about Avedon in the book. And
He influenced my brother, aspired to
be
Avedon. We met Avedon. Blake met him, too, of course. And,
and
yes, the way those circles of life look. I felt it too. You know, I tried not to write too much about the New Yorker in this book because it gets a bit icky writing about the place you work. But for me, you know, I do write about having lunch with Joseph Mitchell, the great writer, and the great piece of advice that he gave me, or the inspiring motto that he gave me, a wild exactitude. That's what writing should aim for, a wild exactitude. And so to meet someone who had lived on terms of friendship with Thurber and White and Liebling, all of those writers who at the age of 7 and 8 I had been devouring in a bedroom in Montreal, that was in itself astounding. And of course, he was not astounded by it, I was astounded by it. For him, they were just, you know, Jim and Joe and Phil, and they were the guys that he had come of age with, who had gifts and deficits like all of us.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. As I said before we started, I'm a great admirer and fan of your work, that this book was such a delight to read, and I appreciate your time today.
I really enjoyed talking and thank you for reading it.
The book is called At the Stranger's Gate, Arrivals in New York. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Adam Gopnik, joined me on the line from Kingston in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.